Why is this happening to me again? Right now, I would answer that question by saying because I'm quite lucky to have the opportunity to speak with folks like today's guest, Dr. Michael Rice. But this is a question he heard so many times as the founder and director of the Heartland Institute in the Ozarks. He wrote a book with just that title. He is former director of the Kaboris Manuscript Foundation, which has translated this important work from the Aramaic language. And Michael has put some very ancient common sense principles to use. I'm Robin Clare. Stay tuned. This is Tributaries. Michael, welcome.
Delight to be here.
When did you originally write Why Is This Happening to Me? And is there any particular time that you had to either do a major rewrite or shift something in your own life after living the message?
Well, actually, you just, probably took about a two-hour conversation to cover those questions.
I knew I'd just have to say one thing and you'd be off and running.
There you go. We're off. Why Is This Happening to Me Again was written, and it was based in the Aramaic, in particular in the idea of Aramaic forgiveness, which is the exact opposite of what we teach in this culture. You know, in this culture, we're taught, well, you did something terrible that caused all this pain inside of me, but it's okay. I'll forgive you. I'll let you off the hook for this pain that my physiology is producing. In the ancient Aramaic, you would never be invited to forgive another or yourself for anything. That's pardoning work, which is nice work to do. I'll let you off the hook because you've shown me something my physiology holds. But in Aramaic, you'd be handed a tool with which to change what you hold in your physiology. It's a way that you delete or remove your capacity to produce pain.
I've heard you mention in the past that it was the Greek idea where pardoning came from originally.
Right. Something Karl Marx said was that if you want to destroy a society, you change the meaning of its words. Because you can't think logically about words whose meanings are changed. You can't figure it out. And so we've been taught in place of forgiveness that the definition's been changed. I let you off the hook for what's happening inside of me, which does nothing to change what's happening inside of me. Forgiveness originally was how you change what's happening inside of you.
You talk about that as the technology of forgiveness, what
right.
One would learn with the Aramaic.
Right. There was a specific technology developed 2,000 years ago that disappeared almost immediately after the man who initiated the technology left. His name, by the way, was not Jesus, the copy of a Greek god, Zeus. His name was Yeshua. And the core of his teaching, as opposed to the Greek idea of, well, here's a belief system to believe in. In Aramaic, it was, here's a body of work to be done. There's something you need to do about what's going on in your life. And the Why book is about how to work through that work. It's written in a very secular format. There's nothing religious about it because there's nothing religious about the work of Yeshua. It's just, here's how life works. If you're in that, why is this happening to me again? If you like what I said about love your neighbor and you say, I love humanity, it's the people that bother me, then there's work to be done.
You've heard that before, eh?
I've heard that before, yes.
Is this what has come out of the Kaboris manuscript?
Yes, it has come out of the work that we've been doing in the laboratory with the Kaboris, and the book itself was written back in 95, and of course your question about have I had to shift anything in my life? Everything. We literally are taught to live in a pretty insane world. The way that these days that I open the Why Is This Happening to Me Again workshop is, actually my wife opens it, Jeannie, and she'll get up in front of the room and ask, how many here have ever held a newborn child? And of course several people will hold up their hands, and then the question is asked, and in holding, imagine you're holding that newborn child again now. If you were to describe the essence of that child in a single word, what would it be? And we've asked this question of tens of thousands of people cross-culturally, and 100% of the time the answer is some variation on the theme of love. Then we ask the question, well, why does everybody come up with that answer? It's because we know what we are. And our culture comes along and deeply embeds its thumbprint upon us. And then Jeannie will ask a second question. The second question is, how many have ever done something you regret? Of course, everybody grins and laughs and puts their hand up. And then the request is, okay, go back to the moment at which you did something you regret. and identify what you were feeling. And she makes a list on the board, you know, asking the question about the newborn and its love, awesome, beauty, peace, you know, incredible words. And then for the people who are doing things they regret, what are you feeling? Anger, rage, sadness, grief, shame, pain. And never does anything from the newborn side of the board ever show up on the regret side of the board. Nothing from the regret side of the board ever shows up on the newborn side. Why? Because our minds are structured by a world of hostility or fear. If we buy into the hostilities and fears of the world, we destroy ourselves. And interestingly enough, in the ancient Aramaic language, the word that described bringing an energy in that didn't belong in your structure was the word sin. It wasn't something you were to be identified with. It's not something that you were. It was just a word that described. It actually is an archery term. When you fired at the bullseye and you missed the bullseye, the scorekeeper yells, sin on the archery range. You missed.
Yes.
Take another shot. And you know, when they said the wages of sin is death, that wasn't some kind of theological threat. It was just if you put enough energy that's off the mark into your tissue structure, it literally turns into chemistry and your body falls apart. And in fact, there's a cell biologist, Bruce Lipton, who's now showing that when you think a thought, that thought produces a molecule called a neuropeptide. The neuropeptide circulates in your structure till it finds a cell with a receptor site that matches. It lands on the cell and the cell replicates the neuropeptide chemically, and you're now living literally with the chemistry of your thoughts.
Right.
Hating someone else is like taking a poison and hoping they'll die. And they're not going to die from the poisons you take. The work of Yeshua was about how do we get back to living as beings of love? You know, when they asked him, what was the first law? The first law was love. And when you think of the Creator, when you think of a neighbor, and in Aramaic that means anybody that you think about, and when you think of yourself, you want to stay connected to your being, love. And if you give that up, then you're in sin, you're in error, and you're going to destroy yourself because your chemistry will downgrade into whatever qualities of energy you're looking at. Our culture has become totally focused in hostility and fear. And 100% of the time when we ask people, how many have done something you regret, the answer is always based in hostility or fear. Because it makes us stupid. Because when we're in hostility or fear, we as human beings are working with corrupt data. And until we learn to dump or forgive that data, it's going to keep taking over. And everybody makes these wonderful resolutions. They get into a space of, oh, yes, my life is going to be different. But if they don't have the tools with which to change what's going on in what we identify as carbon-based memory, then it's not going to be long before carbon-based memory takes over, the old habits take over, and off we go on the same track. And so much for the New Year's resolutions. Until you can go in and take out what drives behavior in the direction of what's against your resolutions, sooner or later, that stuff's going to come back up and take over again. That goes back as far as Paul. He says, you know, he's done this beautiful writing about love, but in the last analysis in his life, what does he say? Why is it the things I would do, I cannot do? And the things I would not do are what I do. He didn't know how to change the content of his own carbon-based memory, and that's the core teaching of Yeshua.
I've heard you mention that it's not a philosophy, but a physics and a physiological system. Let's move into the, as you call it, technology of forgiveness. What are the ground rules?
The number one ground rule is that when my mind is operating, my responsibility is to be absolutely intolerant of any form of hostility or fear, no matter what the situation I'm in. Because if I'm in hostility or fear, how many have done something you regret? Regret comes from doing things when we're out of intelligence, out of contact with our essential nature, which is love, which is where choice is, which is where intelligence is. And so we disconnect from intelligence. So the first ground rule is, I'm going to stay connected to my intelligence, no matter what anybody does. Now, of course, the world doesn't particularly want you to be in your intelligence because then you're not very controllable or very useful to those who would use you. And so the first order of business is, regardless of what the world says or does, regardless of the thumbprints the world tries to put on me, thank you very much, I'm going to stay connected to my essential nature, which is love. I'm not giving it up for anything. And if you can come along and give me the look and bring up something less than love in me, then I'm going to apply the tool of forgiveness to remove that hostility or fear that degrades my physiology, my intelligence, and my ability to make choices. they'd be the number one ground rules. Not an easy thing to do in our culture. Big level of responsibility.
I see shame happening in my granddaughter if she does something, quote unquote, wrong. It's just, it's heartbreaking.
Yeah. Well, the nicest gift you can give her, and if you go to my website, www.whyagain.com, on the right-hand side, there's a place that says download worksheets. And there's, when you click on that, there's a thing that says new chapter 24. There's the new edit from my new book on chapter 24, which is the instructions on how to forgive. Download that, sit with your granddaughter, and start to work with her on worksheets on shame. And guess what? You'll help her to remove shame from her carbon-based memory system. You know, if you look at, you know, let's take a step back, and instead of the religious model of Yeshua's life, let's look at the practical aspect of it. He says the goal is to live in love. And when we're not, there's work to be done. If you look at that idea of, you know, you think about the first time you held your granddaughter, what was her essence? What was her nature? It's nothing but the absolute presence of love.
Right.
And if you can teach her to forgive her shame, see, if her brother does something and she goes into shame over what he does, you know, and I don't know if she's got a brother, but using that as an example, and she goes into shame, then there's nothing for her to forgive her brother for because he brings up shame. In fact, when you really understand the work of Yeshua, she would be thanking her brother, gee, I didn't know I had this shame in me. Thank you for showing it to me. Now I can dump it. Now I can get rid of it. We've had children as young as 4 successfully using that worksheet process. And when they go into stress, they go to their parents at 4 and say, Mom, Dad, I need a worksheet.
That's great.
And they actually grow up doing the work. It's just, it's amazing. Amazing to watch the kids because they know better.
Right.
They know that they're not designed for that hostility and fear.
I have a friend who's teaching his daughter that what she thinks is none of her business. And the stories he comes up with are brilliant. It's so fun. If she goes into fear, she just starts saying, what I think is none of my business. What I think is none of my business. And it works.
Right, right. Yeah, it's just amazing, but the tool is there. You know, why did Paul say, why is it the things I would do I cannot do, and the things I would not do are what I do? He didn't know how to forgive. He didn't know how to remove from his own carbon-based memory. You know, if you live in the mind of love, in the ancient technology, the ancient teaching, you're living in what was called the mind of Christ. That's the mind Christ thought with. And you know, Paul had this piece right on track. He said the goal of the work was to be of like mind with Christ. Nothing religious about this. He lived in the mind of love. That's all.
Right. And the Christ, I don't see the Christ really even having anything. Well, it had to do with Yeshua or Jesus, as some people or most people call him, in the fact that that's what he was living, the Christ way.
Right, exactly. Yeah, there wasn't a man named Jesus Christ. There was, if you go back to the original, it was Yeshua, the Christ. The Christ was an office. It was a title. It actually, in Aramaic, literally means the buttered one. They anointed
really?
A holy man with oils. And so he was the awakened or the anointed one that lived differently than everyone else. He lived in the mind of love. No matter what people did to him, he lived in the mind of love. And when he invites us to do that, he's in essence saying there's work to be done. You know, if you listen to when they ask him, what's the first command? It's love, God, neighbor, self. But then he takes it a whole step further a little later in his teaching. He says, this is my commandment, that you love one another. And then he goes on to say what it means to believe in him. He says, as I have loved you. There's nothing religious about it. It's just here's how you get to live as a human being. And so, you know, if you think of that living in a mind of love as you or I or he living in the Christ mind, and Paul talks about that as Christ in you, your hope of glory. It's not religious. It's just living in love is what's going to bring you into everything you're designed for. What would the opposite of the Christ mind be? Obviously, it would be the Antichrist. And, of course, people have convinced us there's some kind of dude out there that's going to get us. But if you look at that Antichrist mind, you know, it is your own carbon-based memory system. And, you know, if you ask a modern-day physiologist, what is your body, so-called body, made of, they'll tell you that the base element is carbon. And when you ask them what the atomic number of carbon is, they'll tell you that it's 6. There are 6 electrons, 6 protons, 6 neutrons. And that's a data storage system that is your physiology. And if your physiology, you know, when they said the sins of the fathers are passed, yea, into 3 and 4 generations, that wasn't a threat. That was simply, here's how your body works.
Certainly, yes.
If you integrate into your structure some form of hostility or fear and never work through it, it is literally holographically stored in every cell in the structure, including the sperm and the egg. And when you conceive a child, that child would have in their structure every thought, every feeling, every reality in their carbon-based memory system.
And that's certainly something Bruce Lipton, as you mentioned earlier, brings up for people. And, you know, you have these doctors who just have turned their diets around and everything, but they end up keeling over from the same heart attack that their father had at age 55, because it's not just about food. It's not just about any one thing. It is much deeper than that. And I love that this book is so clear.
Well, you know, there are people who will talk about how, you know, bad diet causes diseases and good diet heals diseases, and that's simply not true. Bad diet, going toward a poor diet, is someone who has something in them that they don't want to look at, that they don't want to deal with. And in order to anesthetize or suppress that, they'll be attracted to some form of drug, chemical that will drug them, anesthetize them, or suppress their vitality enough that they can keep things hidden from themselves. And you can counsel them and threaten them with all the diseases they'll get if they don't clean up their diets. And if they don't ever deal with what it is that they don't want to look at, they will go back to that original diet, though it kills them. When you give people a dietary regimen that is vital, that's a wonderful gift, and it steps up our energy, but then the real healing happens. That's a support system for healing, but the real healing happens when we've got the tools and the technology. When anger, rage, grief, pain, trauma of any sort surfaces, how do you forgive it? How do you get rid of it? That's the technology of forgiveness.
Michael, how would you describe meditation, and what kind of practice do you practice?
Well, my main form of meditation is my teaching. That's when I receive information and am taught. But meditation, to me, there's a two-path body of work. One direction or one aspect of the path is to stand connected to that space of love and spend time there. Spend time every day in the Christian language, in the Christ mind. Nothing religious about it. The Buddhists would say, spend time with Buddha. Spend time in that connected space. That strengthens our being. That takes us back to love if we're using meditation for its proper purpose. I see many people who use meditation as a drug. They get themselves into trauma, and they go, oh, I got to go meditate. And they go meditate and get back connected, and then they go out and create more trauma. And I got to go meditate. And they're drugging themselves with meditation rather than using meditation for its real purpose, and that is to be in a connected space with original being, with the love that we are. And so that's one half of the path, and the other path is, or the other half of the path, because you've got to do both in a balanced way, is to be removing from carbon-based memory all the hostilities and fears of all the generations. And when you start looking at the generations, you know, if you go back just 4 generations, that's 31 lives. And when you think about the thoughts, the feelings, the experiences of your own life, the challenges you've been through, and perhaps the traumas, and then you look at, what do you know of what your parents, your mom and your dad, each went through? That's all born and bred in you. Their parents and their parents. It comes up to 31 lives when you go back 4 generations. And, of course, where did the 4th generation back get their carbon-based memory? But from the previous 4, who got it from the previous? We've got 1,000 generations in there.
That's why I like just going back to the source. You can just cut out all the middlemen and go back to that initial Christ being.
Right. Right. That's the purpose of meditation. And then the work, you know, if you look at Paul's life as an example, for instance, he's struck on the road to Damascus. He has a full-blown experience of life, of being connected to love, his essential nature. But then he comes back and he has to go through the struggle of, how do I live this now that I know it's possible? Many people go through what they call a near-death experience. Actually, a near-death experience isn't a near-death experience. It's a near-life experience.
Right.
Because when somebody lives out of their carbon-based memory system, life can be pretty insane. If they are, like, for instance, there's a really phenomenal movie that really shows the journey. It's called Saved by the Light, and it's a true story of Danyon Brinkley. And Danyon, he was just on CBS the other day. Danyon went through being struck by lightning. Danyon was, by his own admission, a very mean man. Let's just keep it simple like that. And the movie shows his meanness and his abusiveness and his propensity to kill. He was a government killer. And he's struck by lightning. And when he's struck by lightning for 28 minutes, his body is dead. In other words, his carbon-based memory shuts up. His being gets an opportunity to experience life. This is not a near-death experience. It's a near-life experience. And, you know, the main phrase that, and he repeats it often in the movie about his life, the main phrase he comes back with that he was told is, you are a powerful spiritual being, and love makes the difference. And so here's this guy who's been a bully and a just nasty all his life, and he comes back, and what does he start to do? He starts to teach about love. And the main thing that he's now, I think, becoming famous for is Danyon Brinkley goes into, as a military man, he goes into government facilities where these soldiers are dying, and he sits with them and supports them in processing all the hostility and fear and insanity that they had to do before they die. And he started hospice centers in VA facilities all over. But he had a near-life experience and brought life back. Paul had a near-life experience, but he didn't know how to empty his carbon-based memory. The technology of forgiveness was lost. And so, though he knows there is that light and that presence of love, he can't live it because he doesn't understand what Yeshua taught about how you forgive from your heart the wrongs of your brother. Now, that's a quote from Yeshua, and interestingly enough, for almost 2,000 years in the Western world, we've lived without being able to translate that word heart. And what we now know, with the unconscious having been rediscovered just a few decades ago, is what Yeshua is saying is you've got to remove from your unconscious that which you put into your brain's image of your brother. Because, of course, you're pretending you have nothing to do with your hostility and fear. It's all, you made me angry, you made me sad, you made me afraid. And so we literally take what's inside of us we don't want to deal with, we eat junk food to keep it suppressed, and then we use it to build our brain's image of others. They show up in our mind with our problem attached, and we swear it must be their problem.
Right. You know, I have to say in I don't know if defense is the right word, because there's no reason to ever get defensive, but I think our audience with Tributaries is way beyond that place of blaming others.
Yes. Cool.
So there's great progress being made.
Well, you know, the work you've been doing for so many years with your whole radio show is so phenomenal at opening that space for people. And yes, we're talking about John Q. Average that's still playing the game of, it's all everybody else's fault.
Right. You know, Michael, the last two guests, one was an astrointuitive / transpersonal psychologist, and another one was a scientist, and they all distilled it, the same as we're doing today, is it all comes down to love. I feel like my last Tributaries, which I don't have a plan for that at the moment, it'll be 3 minutes long with the Beatles song, All You Need Is Love.
All you need is love. That's it. That's the bottom line. And, of course, the key is, how do you get there? And the way you get there is removing from carbon-based memory what doesn't belong there. You know, one of the things I've worked with a lot over the years is A Course in Miracles, and there's a very powerful passage in The Course in Miracles that says, you need not seek for love. You need only seek, find, and release the barriers you've built within yourself against it.
Yes.
And kind of one of the tongue-in-cheek lines I'll offer oftentimes in my workshop is, you know, if they're the one with the problem, why are you the one with the pain? If we have pain, it's because we're holding an energy in us that doesn't belong there. Pain is just a marker for sin, for, again, an energy that's off the mark, for an energy that doesn't belong there. When we're in pain, stop. Delve into oneself and remove the energy that's creating the pain, and it's always going to be some form of hostility or fear, and you're freed from it. And the purpose of life, you know, and before we, in the ancient language they said, defiled our temples, before we defiled our temples, the purpose of life was aliveness, joy, and creativity. And the minute that we defile our temples, the purpose of life changes. And at that moment, the purpose of life becomes to kick us right square in the limitation.
If I may ask you one more question, I'd love to hear you speak about prayer.
Prayer. Oh, prayer is wonderful in the Aramaic. Prayer means to set a trap for God. Now, in this culture,
like
that's
it.
Like, well, what is that? What do you mean by that? Well, if you think about your TV antenna, although they're almost a thing of the past, your TV antenna is a trap. If it's the right shape and oriented correctly, it is a trap for channel 2. So when you orient your TV antenna properly, it traps or picks up that signal, and your TV expresses channel 2 in beautiful, crystal clear, high definition with beautiful, clear sound. If you go up and bend the arms on the antenna and turn it the wrong way, you're not going to get that frequency coming through your television. The human organism, like that TV antenna, is specifically designed for a single purpose, and its purpose is to be a trap for God. To be the receiver that literally brings in the love of God and physiologically expresses it through this human form into the world. We are designed to live. You know, I can remember when I was a kid, they used to say, you know, there's a quote that says, there'll come a time when your whole life will become a prayer. And you know, as a kid, prayer to me was down on your hands and knees, oh, our Father, or whatever. And all I could imagine was square knees. but literally, there's a very deep and real meaning to it, that you're designed to be the expression of love in the world. And when you are aligned properly, when you remove from carbon-based memory what doesn't belong there, you literally become the expression of love everywhere you turn, no matter what happens, the most disastrous experiences. I did a workshop in Atlanta a couple of years ago, and there was a young woman who came up before the workshop and said, Michael, I want to thank you for saving my life. I was like, well, wait a minute, what did I have to do with saving your life? So when you were here last year, I did your whole series of workshops, and one of the things you talked a lot about in the workshop was conscious, active, present love, conscious, active, present love, conscious, active, present love. And she said, about 6 months ago, I came home from work, went into my apartment, locked my door, and found myself locked in my apartment with a man who had a knife who said he was going to rape me and kill me. He stripped me. He held a knife to my throat and began to rape me. And she said, your words, conscious, active, present love, rang in my head. She said, I don't know how I did it, but all of a sudden, I shifted into that. And when I did, I looked at him, and I could see the stark, raving terror on his face. And it didn't matter at that moment that he was raping me, and I knew he was going to kill me. She said, all I could feel for him at that moment was compassion. She was in the first law. She said the minute she went into that compassion and looked at him through the eyes of love, he began to cry. He dropped his knife and ran out of her apartment. That's the power of living the first law. If we can get a critical mass of people who will live as the active presence of love, we'll begin to dissolve all of the insanity.
Dr. Michael Rice. For any guest information, to listen to archives, share resources, and sign up for weekly programming, it's tributariesradio.wordpress.com. And for podcasting on iTunes, Tributaries Radio. I'm Robin Clare. Thanks for staying tuned.